This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, it's good to have both of you here in one place again.
Cool. All good.
At least virtually, right?
Yes, that's right. Exactly.
Well, you're in the living rooms of all of our listeners when you are in the ears.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. How you doing, Nathan?
Yeah, in the ears, at the gym, on the dog walk.
Yeah.
And, you know, driving down the road.
Everywhere.
Yeah, that's what we shoot for.
Yeah. Well, you know, Dr. Lyle, I'm doing great because I opened up my email. I'm subscribed to Medscape, which is a popular subscription for a lot of medical articles and kind of the newest research and different things. So every so often I'll see something about, you know, diet or, you know, some sort of whole natural foods approach or some fasting or some psychology thing. And I'm always just validated because I just see things that you've been saying for many, many years and decades. And last week, August 10th, I was very surprised because the name of the article in Medscape was, "Is the Basis of Antidepressant Treatment a Fraud?" And I thought, whoa, this is, you know, what kind is this? And so I clicked on the article, started reading it. Turns out in a little bit earlier this year, maybe a month or so ago, in the Journal of Molecular Psychiatry, there was a major study, I think out of the UK it was, titled "The Serotonin Theory of Depression, Systematic Umbrella Review of the Evidence." And it turns out the head researcher basically said, most people think depression is caused by a chemical imbalance or by low serotonin, and that's what many doctors tell people who are depressed. But he goes on to say that it's been known in academic circles that no good evidence has ever been found of low serotonin in depression, but drug company marketing has amplified the chemical imbalance and low serotonin hypothesis.
Yes.
You can read this study for people who want. It's the Molecular Psychiatry Journal, 2022. But he ends up concluding saying, our time is better spent by changing circumstances that lead to depression rather than trying to decipher the chemical equation of depression. And I thought, gosh, well, it's about time he started saying what Dr. Lyle, you've been talking about for 12 years since Anatomy of an Epidemic came out.
Sure.
So yeah. What do you think, Dr. Lyle?
Well, I'll tell you what, I read a little, I just read a little blurb about this. I didn't know what journal it was, so I haven't read the big article. But when I read the I think it was a article in the Telegraph out of the UK, I thought, okay, this is very interesting. The first I liken it to the little kid that you know, one mom calls the other mom and said, your kid was smoking, you know, in my bathroom, and so we've got the goods on him, and so now you confront your child and they say, well, actually, I was over there and Jimmy was smoking, and then he handed me a cigarette when his mom knocked on the door, and so I had it in my hand, but I wasn't actually smoking. It was Jimmy, but you know, because it was his mom, you know, I took the hit for it, but it isn't really true.
And anyway, I didn't inhale.
That's it. So that's what this looks like. So it goes like this. So this guy now has kicked the props out of two of the pillars, and at least with he may have done a better job, but the popular article in the press said, hey, what do you know about this? The serotonin theory of depression turns out to be wrong. Hey, what do you know about that? The other evidence indicates that it's negative life events that cause depression. Door number three is, gee, I wonder why the antidepressants work then. Okay. We're going to have to continue to investigate that interesting question. And of course, that's the old, I didn't inhale. The third part of it is, of course they don't work. And any data that says they work is a fraud, for God's sakes, just like the rest of it. But that's
has
okay.
From day one.
That, yeah, of course. And so, that, no, I mean, this was very entertaining. I mean, Robert Whittaker is a really fine writer. And in one of the passages somewhere in Anatomy of an Epidemic, he talks about the process by which they got FDA approval for the various SSRIs. And he explains that in one research study after the next, when they would test themselves against each other's stuff. So Pfizer is going against Merck, okay, with, you know, Luvox versus Prozac or whatever the hell it is. It miraculously, in every case, none of the other antidepressants worked, but theirs did.
Yeah.
It's like accidentally extremely informative.
Right, exactly. Like, gee, we weren't paying attention that the other guys were doing the same thing to us, that they're all submitting the same horseshit to the FDA. And like, gee, there isn't somebody at the FDA that's looking at this and saying, well, that's remarkable. 16 times out of 16, when you guys rated yourself in supposedly random assignment and condition clinical trials with your drug against the other four or five drugs, you had an effect, but they didn't. That's remarkably consistent how this happened over and over and over again. Obviously, your FDA is totally worthless. They're corrupt as shit. You know what I mean? They're either corrupt or stupid, and what difference does it make?
Even back then.
Yes.
It's only gotten worse.
Oh, yes. And so, yeah, now you can really forget it. But the point is that, one thing, though, is Albert Bourlak tested for COVID.
Yes, but don't worry. He's very grateful that he's vaccinated and double boosted, and he's already, you know, on the proper treatment protocol and on the antivirals, and you know, he's just very grateful, because otherwise it would surely be worse.
Because that would be very educational. That would be a little cattle prod to a lot of the midwits that something is incredibly rotten in Denmark and you haven't been paying attention and you've been duped. So
I don't know. I think you have unintended consequences and all kinds of pre-existing cognitive bias where it just doubles down on what a scary disease it is and how we all need to be terrified of it. And even if you're vaccinated, it can take you down.
You know what? You're so right. This was incredibly demonstrated by Lauren and Gene Chapman at the University of Wisconsin in the late 1960s with test bias in projective tests like the Rorschach. And so it didn't matter how much evidence you stacked against the Rorschach, you could not shake clinicians. You know, there's just no way that it didn't make any difference. So
So you can't win.
You can't win.
Either somebody, you know, he sails through it and it's only because he's vaccinated.
Yes.
Or he dies and it's because it's such a horrible, scary disease.
Right.
And so we still have to maintain the state of emergency indefinitely.
Jen, you're upsetting me, even though you're telling me the truth.
Jen's in a very cynical state of mind at this current juncture.
You got it. Well, but at any rate, the point of all
exactly.
this is that so two of the three props have now been kicked out, and you're going to watch. You just watch how much ink goes in the water over the next year over this, because. The intelligent people that they really have to be worried about are not so much the public, but it's all their psychiatrists.
Mm.
You know what I mean? That not every psychiatrist is a, you know, is a pigeon that pecks a key for food. Like, some of them actually have a few brains.
And conscience.
Yeah,
and a conscience. And so they're going to be like, whoa. Like, I'm thinking of a psychiatrist now that's friendly with Jen and I, and I think he's, quote, he'll disagree with me, you know, about what he thinks is true about some medications from time to time. And I sent him to Adam and Epidemic, and he's read it. And I think that what will be useful for people like that are open-minded and intelligent and curious, but trust me, it's hard to, you know, if you're a Laker fan, it's going to be really hard to find out that, you know, your three favorite Lakers were involved in a criminal scheme. You know what I mean? That's going to be tough. And in the same way, if you're a psychiatrist that through your career you've been prescribing and going to conferences and try to be respected by your peers, and now you find out it's not so good, and now, you know, now where do we go with the last mile? What if it turns out that it's just like Whitaker says, the whole damn thing is a very carefully, unbelievably orchestrated fraud, and you're doing more damage than you ever did any good? What about that? Okay. And so now where do you go? And the answer is there's only one place with any integrity to go. You go in the business of being the psychiatrist that gets people off medications and manages their withdrawal, which means you're taking other people's patients and, you know, and
they're doing better.
I don't know that you get, you know, I don't know how you make a living doing that. And at more,
well, you also you're, study up on the ACE literature.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the
the life events that are now leading to depressive episodes are not the actual competitive problems in your current life, which is the actual reason that you're feeling depressed, but it's these right. long distant childhood insults that we can document on an ACE score.
Yeah, whatever. Anyway, it's going to be interesting because I think the ink in the water that you're going to see is going to be this mealy mouth talk about how, gee, we don't know why this stuff works, but it does. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And Dr. Lau, you're hitting it on the head. I mean, if anybody wants a lesson in spin, this article, they wanted to get the other side. So they contacted a professor of psychiatry and pharmacology in Toronto, Canada. And of course, he said exactly what he said. Well, there's still a very incomplete understanding about the pathogenesis of major depressive disorder, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't use this, you know, that doesn't mean that there's still that doesn't negate the efficacy, safety, and tolerability of serotonin-based antidepressants.
Wow. The safety and tolerability.
Written at a meeting between the lawyers and the marketing department.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what that was.
Because, you know, there's no cost to these drugs, of course. You know, they're completely safe and you know, effective in many cases.
Sure.
And what's the harm in just being on them anyway?
Of course.
It's just like, you know, putting walnuts on your oatmeal or something.
Exactly.
It's perfectly
harmful. Insulin for diabetes.
Exactly.
That's all it is. Exactly. It's medication.
Everyone
not drugs.
We know the drugs
let's
work.
Let's put statins in the water just preemptively,
yes.
because there's no secondary effect or, you know, any harm whatsoever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that's great, Nathan. That's all. I mean, it's always good. Well, you know, the good news is that, it's always good to see, you know, it's actually really not particularly fun. There's a really nice place to be in the world, which is you don't want to be so far out in front of the curve that you lose your license and then you get thrown in jail. That's not a good place to be. And that's where Alan Goldhammer lived most of his career. He knew damn well he was way too far out in front of the curve. And that he had to be unbelievably careful to not get thrown in jail and bankrupted and, you know, lose all licensure, et cetera, and be hung in the public square. So finally, you know, they win a Nobel Prize for autophagy, and that, you know, fasting clearly facilitates that. And Walter Longo comes along, and now Alan is feeling like, hey, now the pack is in sight. I can see him in my rearview mirror now. I mean, they're little tiny thing. They look like ants in the rearview mirror, but they're there. And that is a way more comfortable place. And I'm sure Alan's thinking, great, I'm freaking 63 years old. You know, I got to live my whole professional life in anxiety over this. But now, finally, I get to relax. And that's what it feels like with this. I mean, I certainly felt at times like, okay, Doug, it's a good thing we didn't have Beat Your Genes in 2002. All we had was True North Health Center's lecture, and there I could go off. And it's like, well, there's only 16 people in the audience, so I can do this. And hilariously, Alan called me when I was driving home one time and said, "What did you tell those people in the lecture today?" And I said, I told him the story of Whitaker and what dog shit, trash, and rat poison the psychiatric meds were. And he says, yeah, but we got a problem. We got people threw all their meds in the toilet, you know what I mean, et cetera. And so we got, And I said, I told him to do it slowly. I told him to take, you know, go down 10% a month. He goes, well, nobody heard it.
Man.
So in the safest place
Bunch
in the world,
patients,
I go off, yeah, and I get in trouble from the head man as he's in anxiety like 3 hours later. That was an interesting lesson. So, the point is now this kind of criticism, now we can see the little men in the rearview mirror. You know, they only look 2 inches tall, but at least they're there.
You know, I read Anatomy of Epidemic, and to me it was a very sad book.
Yeah.
I mean, I know many acquaintances, you know, I play mm-hmm. hockey, I'm friends with a few people, kind of acquaintances, and it's like they're given out antidepressants, especially in the last few years with the pandemic, where obviously so many people gained weight and they were obviously feeling depression, as we would expect, as from what you and Dr. Hawk have taught us about depression.
Sure.
And it's just so sad that majority of these people won't ever come off of them based on the history mm-hmm. of these things. And
it's like, you know, Dune, once you've had the cinnamon, you can't get out, you're stuck. And this is, that's a hell of a thing. I mean, that it is an extremely sad book. And the more I read about it, the more disturbed I was by all the damage to the neural tissue that was being done. And actually Whitaker himself was, deeply troubled by this. And of course there's evidence that there's considerable damage done, but I would tell people the following, and that is, that it's been my clinical experience watching people using water fasting, that remarkable recovery can take place in water fasting, I believe, to neural tissue, just as we see extraordinary, recovery taking place with water fasting with respect to all kinds of things. So water fasting will show the extraordinary capacity oftentimes for deep house cleaning. I've had people that had scars for 20 years and then they fasted for 18 days and the scar's gone. So the body had the capacity to actually fix that tissue, but was not going to fix it until idealized conditions were set. And so that's why, you know, if you are somebody who is sluggish, a little bit of malaise, you've got a niece that's got a problem like that, and you're now hearing this, and you've heard us talk about this, and it's finally time to maybe look at this carefully and not see us as crackpots, because after all, the Daily Telegraph and the Journal of Molecular Psychiatry, you know, now are backing us up. The possibility that you could actually improve your mind's functioning secondary to possible damage done by psychiatric medication, that's something to get Nathan's help with. Okay, possibly. In other words, you don't have to leave your house. You could get Nathan's assistance at Fasting Escape. Nathan does Dr. Nathan. It's Dr. Nathan here. We just call him Nathan here. But Dr. Nathan has a very sophisticated and carefully orchestrated protocol over years of his clinical experience as a water and fasting supervisor at True North and in his own facility to help people improve them. You know, that would be one thing to do. If you are sluggish and lethargic and not that mentally sharp, and you feel like, quote, you aren't quite what you were before. And of course, it could be other things. Could be the alcohol, the cigarettes, the CBD oil, the lack of sleep. You know what I mean? Gambling, porn addiction. There's a lot of reasons why there could be that. But the truth is, one of them might be, you know, you spent 7 years on antidepressants. You went off a year or two ago, but you're still not what you were in terms of emotional reactivity and clarity 10 years ago. That's where fasting might help you. So I'm not trying to plug you, Nathan. I'm trying to help people as we talk about this issue, because you're absolutely right. It's a sad book. And every one of those people that has been bamboozled and had their lives damaged by the psychopharm industry, you know, deserves the opportunity for as much recovery as they can get.
Yeah, I've had a number of people who they actually, after they feel really good after a fast, they feel less depressed, less anxious, because obviously they're feeling healthier. Exactly how you and Dr. Hawk describe, they should feel when they're getting a better competitive reality.
Right.
But the other thing that they feel is anger, that they wasted so much time under their doctor's direction, and they could have spent their time doing something more useful and worthwhile. And it's very sad. I mean, I've talked with patients, you know, endless times about this, and the anger is really a common theme behind a lot of people's.
Boy, as it should be.
Yeah,
I'm angry, and it's not my brain.
Yeah,
you know. All right, well, let's see what else we got, Nathan.
All right, well, let's go over some questions. So our first question is, dear doctors, I think I have messed up my dopamine reward system, and I don't know how to fix it or if I even want to. I'm early 40s, single, I've been in many relationships. I don't really have trouble attracting men. I think if I just decided that it was time, then I might settle for one, but to me, it's just boring and mundane, and I only feel excited by unpredictable magnetic dynamics with men. For the last couple of years, I've had an online friends with benefits who lives overseas. He's a bit of a high-profile man, and so the reward I felt from attracting him and engaging with him long-term has been very high. But now that I attracted someone so unattainable, I really can't get excited about anyone else. I didn't used to be like this. I had plenty of loser boyfriends in the past. What the F is wrong with me? And if I don't fix it, will I end up alone and be a miserable old person?
Jen, you just got a rip on this one for your own entertainment. Just go ahead.
And Dr. Hawk, before you answer, would this be like, I know you're the political scientist, but with all due respect to the Lewinsky situation, would this be like, you know, the question is, could Monica Lewinsky ever date somebody ever again after she's been with the president, essentially, right?
Oh my God. That wasn't even a question back in 1998. I think she's done just fine. And I think this questioner will also do just fine. You've not messed up your dopamine reward system. You were inaccurately calibrated to the market because you've had a relationship with a magnetic friends with benefit who has been playing you for casual mating this entire time, which the magnetic unattainable types usually will. that's the fact that he is magnetic and unattainable probably is telling you that you're being played for casual mating strategy, just in the overall dynamics of the whole game. So the fact that you've had plenty of loser boyfriends in the past speaks to the capacity of your dopamine reward system to bounce back. It's going to be just fine. And you were just running real-time cost-benefit analyses on the alternatives to this very exciting magnetic strategy that you've got going on. I can't quite tell from the question if this is a current relationship, this is currently happening, or if this is somebody who's kind of been in the past but is fading out. But to the degree that you were still hung up on this guy and foreclosing other relationships because you think he's going to change his mind and lock you down in a pair bond, I think that's probably not likely to come to fruition in the way that you would want it to. I think he's having his cake and eating it too, basically. He's enjoying himself very much. He gets to pursue casual mating strategies with other women because he's overseas and you can't keep an eye on him all the time. He gets some pair bond signals from you, which is nice and friendly for him. He gets to have the girlfriend experience, but he's not paying any of the costs of a pair bond and is probably not super interested in one. And he's tying up your time and energy and has you miscalibrated for the actual dating market that is right in front of you, which currently looks very boring because you're cracked out on a casual mating charismatic cult leader. But as soon as you come back down to earth and go on some dates in your actual locality and recalibrate among the losers, you will find a prince among those frogs.
Yes, she's got some artistry right in there. It's beautiful.
I'm glad we're recording this. This is always beautiful.
You got it. Me too.
So, yeah, I mean, that's the basic. That's just a very general view without knowing more specifics about what's going on with the two of you. But that's generally how I would look at that problem. It's you've not broken your brain. You've temporarily, just like if you spent 3 weeks eating nothing but vegan junk food and then tried to go on an all potato diet, the potatoes are going to sound extremely, extremely bland. You're not going to be that interested. It's not going to be that exciting. But if you were actually feeling some hunger, suddenly you're very interested in a plain potato. So as with tubers, such with men.
So Dr. Hawk, should she go celibate for like a year and then she'll be like happy with the loser boyfriends?
I think she just needs to recalibrate in a way where she's not keeping one foot in this supernormal trap with this guy. And that can be very difficult for a female who's partly snagged a marlin, as Doug would call a guy like this. You know, you've got him on the line and he's pulling your boat across the bay and you're losing sight of shore. But there's a lot of exhilaration and you think you're going to be the one that gets him. And he gives you enough signals to keep you hooked in. And, you know, just when you start to kind of get a little cool on him or you start dating someone else, suddenly he's super interested in you and shooting you all the parabon signals again. And so he just keeps you locked in this dynamic where you think there's still a chance that he's going to turn over to parabon strategy and he's worth holding out for because he's so high value. But it's a rare marlin that does.
Yeah.
so yeah, I think you want to give yourself some meaningful, real distance from this guy, not in a gamey, you know, following the rules kind of way where you play a little hard to get, just hoping to interest him more. That will probably work in the short term, but it's not going to serve your long-term strategy to play those games with him. What's going to serve your long-term strategy is really cutting things off with him and saying, you know, hey, it's been fun. But if you really are interested in finding a pair bond, which I imply from this question, you know, focusing on that search and going all in with those contenders rather than ruling them out before they've even had a chance, because you've got, you know, this very exciting meal that's waiting for you after your appetizers with the poor losers who are trying to vie for your attention.
Wow. Thank you, Dr. Hawk.
All good.
I'm sure Doug has something to add.
That's fine. I don't. No, let's
he doesn't want to get in more trouble already. Now that he's called for Burla's head on, yeah. on the air.
All right. What else we got?
All right. Dear doctors, my partner's parents are in their early 70s, and surprisingly, they still love what they do, jumping out of bed to start work each day as they did 40 years ago. Both of them work in creative fields. It's not clear if they found the perfect careers or if they would take the same excitable, have-at-it attitude to any path they had followed. So the question is, are people who find their dream job genetically predisposed to do so? Is it in their own personalities to work with such passion and positivity, or does everyone have that potential if the right job comes along?
That's a very interesting question, and the truth is going to be some mess in the middle. In other words, we can imagine. Let's look at this in principle. In principle, there is a position, let's go back to the Stone Age village, and there's 50 people in it. And the kids don't have to do anything productive particularly, although they try, but pretty much what they're doing is they're goofing around and playing and learning and observing and asking questions and looking down each other's, you know, serapes or whatever it is that they've got. So that's what they're doing. But the adults are attempting to be as valuable as possible for the village. And so you can imagine a person that is essentially been slated by the village to do some task that is not very glamorous, but they quietly suspect that they have more chops than that. And they can see that they are not very socially facile and that they're not very verbally facile. But actually, they can tell and when it comes to reasoning through and making decisions, that they're actually highly intelligent. So they got it figured out by 22. You know what? I'm smarter than Alpha, but nobody can tell. And because I have a lisp and, you know, whatever it is. So you can imagine the frustration of doing the job that you're doing and being not very happy about it because you are aware that you have the possibility to do something that is more, okay? And in fact, you may not really be happy until you are doing the very most valuable thing that you can do for the village, which incidentally may or may not be something that you inherently enjoy, but there's a really good chance that that is true. So by virtue of in something that has not been easily, is not easily explored, is the notion that the energy conservation circuitry and assessment devices that have to take place in the mind and are incredibly sophisticated, I'm sure. Basically, people will be drawn to things for which they have great talent. The I'm sure that there's place, you know, there's many aspects, many, you could see some guy like, you know, the White Shadow who is not a very great basketball player, but would have loved to have been one. Okay. The, but people that are drawn to things like that. But the, but in general, people are going to like that which they do well, because the liking of it, you can see the possibility where that might not be true, but you can also see where that would likely be the case, because there would be such an high incentives for the reward systems in looking at the esteem processes and what you would get in exchange. You know, the sum total of feedback from exchanges would be greater. As you essentially are an organism that's going to run a lot of little midget tests and be watching carefully in the environment for imitation to find out where should you take your talent. So, you know, Tom Petty said this. He said, you know, he was, you know, looking at people and seeing, you know, some guitar player. And I can't remember what the story was, but the guy didn't look that much different than him. He was just as short and skinny and, you know, et cetera. And Petty just, you know, realized, wait a second, I think I can do that. And so, you know, Tom Petty wasn't going to be your high school quarterback and he wasn't going to be your neurosurgeon. But he thought, you know what, that's something I think I can do. And obviously he wouldn't have even been paying attention if he didn't have some, you know, latent love of music that was probably quite a bit more than the average bear. And so the, anyway, so the issue is that the happiness, high levels of happiness are going to come when you feel like you have situated yourself in a set of circumstances where you're doing a very good job of actualizing your potentials in a way that are optimal for your, you know, esteem gains. That's kind of what it ought to look like. And so the question on the table is, you know, it looks to that from the outside as, quote, they just love what it is they do. They're in the creative fields, okay? Well, if we back it up, we're going to find out that they were successful, okay? That if we backed it up also, we would find that they had some talent in those areas, and that when we looked at what those talents were relative to what their other talents were, they ran a cost-benefit analysis and said, I'm better off taking my, you know, trying to, I don't know, be in the music production business than I am being an RN. Because, you know what, I may not be able to get through RN school. But I actually have a knack for some of this stuff, and I'm going to, for these performance things, and that's what I'm going to do. So, I don't know, I'm just rambling here. I'm trying to come to some conclusion, but I'm getting momentarily lazy. Jen, you tracking this and this all making sense?
That's very convenient. Yeah, I think you're probably winding around to the idea that there's a cocktail here of you've had success. You have innate talent. It's been rewarded by the village. You've had some. There's been a contingency factor here where you've been lucky enough to run into this thing that you're good at and that gains you esteem in the village. Which not everybody. That's not going to happen for everybody. There might be something that you actually are very. You might be very good at pickleball, but you never play a game of pickleball, so you never find out. And that's going to be the case with a lot of creative endeavors. If you never, give something a try and immediately run into at least a little bit of positive feedback for most people, that's going to get you over that initial, skill acquisition period. There's going to be sort of a learning curve for everybody, even somebody who's very talented, where they show some initial aptitude and get some initial positive feedback, but there's still a lot of skill to develop and a lot of talent to grow, and there's some of that is going to be a really unpleasant slog. So you have to have, there has to be a very special mix of a perceived probability to acquire those skills to begin with, which is going to be largely based on the original aptitude that you showed for it. You have to be able to project yourself out into the future and imagine yourself mastering the set of skills that would be necessary to come with the additional reward that you would expect from the village. So all of these things are kind of delicate, and they're not all going to be present with every single possible person that we could plunk down into that kind of situation. Like, oh, you can strum a guitar, you can pick up a tune, there's some girls who think you're kind of cool for doing it. Is that person going to still have that perceived probability of mastery enough to unleash that cycle of intrinsic reward that comes from feeling a quote-unquote passion for being a guitarist? Like, maybe, maybe not. A lot depends on chance, and a lot depends on that person's personality. So that's the other big piece of this here, is that you've got people who sound fairly agreeable and maybe not super open, who were lucky enough to kind of stumble onto something that met all of these criteria very early on and found themselves embedded in a social ecology that kept that feeling of value and rewardedness flowing. And they also have each other to bounce that off of. And so, yes, they jump out of bed, they're excited for work, but they might not be if they were super, super open and got bored very easily with what it is that they do, or if they were very disagreeable and very critical of their own work or other people's work, or felt constantly like they weren't measuring up, or there are just a million different little factors that could go on here. So that's all a long way of answering, does everyone have that potential if the right job comes along? It depends.
Yeah.
The answer is ultimately it depends. But no, not everybody has the potential, because not everybody has the exposure to the circumstances and the innate personality characteristics that meld together into that kind of special sauce.
Right. Everybody has the ability to find what would probably be the optimum deal for them, but the optimum deal for them might not be particularly exciting. So
yeah, right.
As Jen is saying, a great question, because in fact, what it does, who has the parakeet? It's got to be
my
Jen.
My guinea pigs.
Oh.
There's something going on upstairs. So anytime they hear anybody moving in the house, they think they're getting fed. So that's what's happening.
Got it. Yeah, but anyway, yeah.
I call one of them, I've renamed, used to be named Sesame. They all had whole food names.
Yes.
So we've got like chickpea and turtle bean and Sesame. But Sesame has been renamed Norman because that's the sound she makes.
Okay, all good. Yeah, I think that's good, Nathan. I think that pretty well sums that up.
One little piece that I just was curious about, it seems to imply that somebody who's maybe naturally optimistic or someone who's naturally pessimistic, is that, in my head, is that a myth or is there some truth to it?
No, there's huge truth
to
that.
Sure there is.
Yeah, a lot of it comes down to agreeableness. Agreeableness plus openness equals optim.
Interestingly enough, I can look back on... In two minutes here, I can look back on my career, and I can remember hoping that I could be somebody that could inspire other people to make changes in their lives and to be happier. That's what I wanted to do. And I felt like that was possible after listening to Jim Rohn as a teenager and then reading Nathaniel Brandon. And so I thought that that was going to be possible. And so by the time I was, you know, done with grad school, I didn't know that it was possible at all. The whole thing looked like a mishmash of a bunch of mediocrity and that nobody really had any direction. And then when the selfish gene fell into my hands, I realized that the whole damn field was ignorant as hell and that there was a whole nother chance that literally there was truths that could be discerned and that somehow clinically that could be useful. 6 or 7 years later, I'm finally in private practice. Okay, so I did other things. I was an academic and then I was a criminal justice psychologist. And finally, in my late 30s, I've been thinking about EP and the implications of it and utilizing of it in some of the work that I was doing. But I had not really tested it clinically in a big way. So I started my practice in the late 90s. And very soon, probably my third or fourth client was a girl that I desperately wanted to help. Depressed, had trouble sleeping, blah, blah, blah. And I did everything that I could think of and failed. And I remember being really frustrated that I was not succeeding with this client, and it was early. And suddenly I was questioning whether or not all this knowledge that I had gained and actually understood and absorbed from EP that I'd seen all around me for 7 years, and I was actually very knowledgeable about EP at that time. But there was not an EP clinician, and I knew that I was, you know, an early bird in this thing, and I could see no solution. And I have to tell you, that was tough. And Alan kind of chuckled at me because I processed it with him, and he said, yeah, just another young doctor with a tough patient that you can't fix. Oh, well, you'll learn, i.e. sometimes it's just tough shit, okay? Curiously, and thank goodness, it turns out that was an outlier. That was an absolute outlier, okay? And over the next year, I would find that I was amazingly successful relative to anything I had ever seen under CBT. And so it wasn't my brilliance. This was applied Dawkins, Tubi, Cosmides, Buss. In other words, this was just straight education and the obvious implications. So Jen found the same thing, you know, as she started to do her work. And there's nothing like it. So did Rick Seidel. And so the point is that, but let's suppose we in an alternative reality, it's not that useful. So it's interesting knowledge-wise, but it turns out it doesn't actually help people. Well, then I wouldn't be nearly as happy and I wouldn't be nearly as excited about my life and feel nearly as blessed as I do, okay? It would be because the nature of what it is that I can do for the village, it is what it is and it's not that great, okay? And you know what? There's not a damn thing you can do about that. So not everybody gets lucky. John McDougall will tell you over and over again, I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I had the best career and I loved being a doctor. And the reason is he figured out how to get sick people well and he got them well. Not every doctor gets to do that, even though they try. So that's another part of the puzzle.
Totally. Yep.
Dr. Lyle, Dr. All right. Lyle, thank you so, so much. Really, really love it. And I look forward to talking more. Hopefully by next week, they'll discover, you know, more about how you're correct and everybody else is incorrect.
just a matter of time.
As Dr. Goldhammer said, just in time.
Just in time. You got it. All right, Nathan. Thank you very much.
Oh, and to our listeners, please do visit the Living Wisdom Library at www.esteemdynamics.com. And you can become a member, listen to all kinds of content, the weekly or sometimes less often, but the regular live Q&As with Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle. So every other week.
Yeah, every other week. We do that twice a month. Yeah.
Okay, folks. Yep. Thank you, Nathan.
All right, everybody. Have a good night, you guys.
All right, Jen. We'll see you soon.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time. This is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.